Welcome back to the Shit You Don't Learn in School podcast. This is Calvin Rosser.
And this is Steph Smith. And in this week's episode, we are talking about traditions. So how traditions impact the way that we think, the way that we act, and just how immersed we may be in traditions all around us.
Steph, I know you were excited to talk about this idea. I think you maybe first started thinking about it when we were doing our Doing Time Right course and we were exploring, you know, how do people think about time? What are the suboptimal ways in which we are taught to think about time? And how can we rethink that so we actually get more out of our most valuable asset? We've already talked about the course in another episode, so we won't do that now. But I'd love to just understand, what do you mean by traditions and what are we even going to talk about today?
Yeah, so I'll start with the Google definition, which is the handing down of information, beliefs, or customs from one generation to another. So it's basically you're inheriting a system or a thought process or an approach to something that someone else taught you. And something important there is sometimes that person didn't come up with it. It's been handed down for many generations, right? So they might have been told by someone else who was told by someone else who was told by someone else. And there can be positives to this, which is that we don't have to reinvent the wheel every time someone needs to do something. Traditions exist for a reason in some circumstances, but the negative side of that is when a tradition is passed down and it no longer applies or no longer is optimal in that new use case. So you mentioned us revisiting time. That's a great example of a system that is completely uniform for the most part around the world. It is not necessarily the perfect system, but it's good enough for many people, right? That's why we use the 24-hour clock, the 7-day week. But then you start to go down the rabbit hole and you question, what other things that I've been told to believe or things that I've been told to use that maybe don't serve me as well? So things that come to mind there are the 40-hour work week. That's something I've been thinking about a lot recently. We've both worked remotely for a while. I think a lot of other people are coming to terms with this idea of this really was a tradition to some extent. It started in the early 1900s, so it's been around for around a century. And if you think about the way that our world exists today, the technology, the tools that we have, we literally can fit a computer, which is a phone, in our pocket. Does that approach still apply? Does that tradition still make sense? So curious to know what you think about that, of just thinking about the 40-hour work week. And also curious to know if you or others know the history of the 40-hour work week.
Sure. So lots of questions for me there. But I guess I'll just start with this idea. When you were talking about traditions, what came to mind is these are our societal defaults. And these can be both good and bad. And I think we're often unaware of them. They're like the David Foster Wallace analogy. It's the water of the things around us. We don't know we're actually in water. And it shapes our lives in pretty profound ways. Even as you were talking about time, you mentioned we all use time in a universal way. But what I was thinking is, whether it's at the local level, and then especially as you cross to different countries and stuff, what I've seen is actually there's very different traditions with how people think about how to get the most out of their time and what a productive life looks like as it relates to how you spend your time. So in the US, it's very career focused, and that may even be more true in like a New York. And then if you go to the Midwest, maybe people spend a little bit more time hanging out with their neighbors and enjoying life. I'm generalizing a little bit. But then if you go to, say, Brazil or Spain or certain other places, maybe even Japan, you just get very different perspectives on, you know, how one can think about using their time and how something like your career plays into that. And I would call that just broadly these societal defaults that we have. And they're so heavily ingrained in our lives that I don't think you can completely refactor your thinking on all of them. I think exposure to new ideas can certainly help you. But I can't overstate enough that we all think that we've really thought about our lives, but you're so influenced by even the like state or city in which you're born, even like how religious or what religion you were born into or no religion at all. All of these things really shape your thinking. And it actually takes a lot of effort to rethink those things. I think that's what I'm excited to chat about, is how we can do that. So you also asked about the 40-hour work week. I think actually that was something that I was surprised how early in my life I realized that it wasn't for me. I took my first job as an investment banker in New York. It was actually more like the 100-hour work week. So maybe 40 hours would have been fine at that point in my life. But I did realize that going to an office, being in a cubicle, there was something about that that actually didn't resonate with how I wanted to work. And I ended up being quite unhappy with that structure and being constrained to it. Thankfully, I landed a remote job as my next role, and I wasn't even necessarily planning that. But once I discovered remote work and I started traveling and I was able to maybe take an afternoon off to do an activity and no one questioned me about that because I was producing results, It actually just completely rewired how I thought about work. I was more productive. I was happier. I was getting to experience more in my life. And I had actually found a job that was financially comparable to what I would have expected to earn from other more office-based jobs. Now, what's interesting is that seems trite because much of the world moved remote after COVID. But doing that for the first 5 years of my career before other people were doing it, it seemed so obvious to me that it was a better way of working. But talking to my peers who are in the office, they're like, oh, you just can't reproduce the office environment in a remote environment. And there's big disadvantages. And now a lot of people have gotten a taste of remote. Some like it, some don't for various reasons. But it has at least gotten people thinking like, well, is this for me? And I've seen a pretty hard transition for some people. They're like, hell yeah, this is for me. This is a way better system of working. And I resonate with that because that happened for me. And I actually can't imagine going back to an office because it was such a better way of working, at least for my style.
Yeah, I think what's so interesting is you mentioned that traditions are these forces on our lives that influence the way we think, but we don't always recognize how much they're influencing us. What I find so funny about that story, and I resonate with it a lot, is that when you would tell people about remote work, they would say, oh, that can't work for X, Y, and Z reasons, but they never stopped to question the system or the tradition passed down. When we were passed down the cubicle, the 40-hour work week, the Monday to Friday, no one ever stopped for a second to say, wait a minute, is this really the optimal way of doing things? Because again, our brains are just, they're systems that can't reinvent the wheel all the time. And so there is a degree to which we readily inherit systems and don't think about them.
I wasn't looking for a remote job, and I'm not sure that I ever would have. I just ended up randomly having a friend who was working for this company. He was traveling the world. His life seemed exciting, but I wasn't necessarily looking to make that transition because I didn't really know that you could get a serious career doing something like that. And that was actually one of the roadblocks I ran into in the early days of talking with friends. They're like, oh, you're just taking some not serious job and you're just gallivanting around the world. Or people assumed I'm like a trust fund kid and I'm pretending to work. And there are all of these just assumptions passed on to me. And I'm like, no, actually my job is pretty legit and I work pretty hard. And I actually felt like I was moving up a steeper learning curve in my career. It wasn't just, oh, I'm making a quick buck as a freelancer so I can go travel the world. It unlocked acceleration across multiple domains. And I attribute a lot of that to just luck. But my point is, I don't think I would have ever necessarily questioned it because very few to little people around me were doing it. But COVID was a societal shock in that many people just got thrown into this new way of working and it forced them to think about it. To get back to one of your earlier questions where we can start about the most important thing with a tradition is how was it formed and why was it formed? So you mentioned the 40-hour work week. If I had to guess, the 40-hour work week probably correlated with the rise of factory and widget work. So we moved from like farmers to industrial people. And as a way of measuring industrial production, it was all about the time you spent in the factory because more time equals more widgets produced equals more output. And of course, there's like improvements in efficiency in the actual system and the tools. But workers got measured based on that because that actually led to direct profits for the company. Now what's interesting, and we talk about this in our course, Doing Time Right, is that work today, you can have outsized impact with 2 hours of amazing work or really good ideas in ways that generate far more output than grinding away for 40 hours does. And you can't always produce it. And so your efforts are not linearly correlated with the output that a company is looking for. And so that unlocks new ways of thinking about work.
Exactly. So I think most traditions start from a place of first principles, or at least thinking about a system in an optimal way. And that's the truth when you think about, as you mentioned, the Industrial Revolution. So it's not like the 40-hour work week never made sense. It's just a question of whether it makes sense in our current lives with our current tools and the society that we live in today, what we have access to. So the Industrial Revolution happened hundreds of years ago, so around 1760 or so. At that time, people were working 10 to 16 hour days, over 6 days a week. So a lot more than today. You're talking 60 to 80 hour weeks. I know some people, you mentioned in banking, still do this, but a majority of the people don't do that today. And due to that extreme level of work, what people were pushing for was something more reasonable. So there were labor unions, labor rights activists, and they were all pushing for 8 hours a day, 8 hours labor, 8 hours recreation, 8 hours rest. And a lot of people still go by this mantra today. What's interesting is a lot of people think of Henry Ford as the person to really revolutionize the 40-hour workweek. And what he did was basically a lot of people in his company were working 48 hours a week. And he tested to see if 48 hours or 40 hours would be more effective. And he saw, oh, actually, people were just as, if not more effective across the 40-hour workweek. And so he implemented that across his company. And I think it was in 1938 that Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which required employers to pay overtime to anyone who worked more than 44 hours a week. And then in 1940, that was switched to 40 hours. The reason I'm sharing this history is because a lot of people, I think today, believe that the 40-hour workweek is like this optimal approach to work. And really what it was an alternative to something much worse, which was, again, people working 60 to 80 hour weeks in these factories. And today, not only do we have more tools, but no one ever tested the 30-hour workweek or the 20-hour workweek or any of these alternatives like asynchronous work or the things that we have available to us today. So the 40-hour workweek was not only rooted in industrialism, but it hasn't really been retested. There's some companies that are allowing more flexible work structures today, especially after COVID. Iceland did a test of a 4-day work week versus a 5, and now is actually allowing, I think it was 86% of its population to either move to that 4-day work week or at least have the right to move to it. And so I think what I'm trying to get to is this idea that a lot of traditions, as we talked about already, they're just adopted. They're readily adopted because you see everyone else around you adopting this. And you think even subtly that, of course, this must be optimal or of course, this must be thought through. And again, it may have been thought through in the past, but over time, there's going to be a wider delta between what's optimal as the world evolves and what people are doing. In this case, I think we've gotten to the point where that delta is pretty significant and it's time for people to rethink whether that system still works.
I think another interesting thing on this system in particular is it seems mostly optimized for employers. Employers held all the cards because they had your pensions and they paid your wages and there weren't a lot of other options. And for the most part, that's still true. But now the most productive people, they actually have more opportunities than they have time to do those opportunities. They can shift the discussion to what they need and what's valuable for them. And I think there's probably also a philosophical or psychological shift towards happiness now that many of our basic needs are met and we're focused on like, how do we live a fulfilling life instead of how do we do our moral duty to serve our employer over 20 years? And as that psychological and societal shift has played out, then you also see people rethinking the work week naturally because 40 hours may not actually be good for my own personal satisfaction, even if it's good for the employer. And it may be true that really widely different models work well for me. Like I work really hard 60 hours a week for 3 years and then I take a year off. Maybe that's actually the best model for me. Or maybe I work really hard for 3 days per week and then take 4 days of rest. Or maybe I really grind away when I'm excited and log off when I'm not. And I think you're starting to see more of that intersection of what works for different people. And the people with the skills and leverage can now create these new paradigms where they're a bit more in control of their time because the companies have to listen to that at this point.
Yeah, I think what's important here is, like you said, just rethinking things, testing things for yourself. Just consider that, okay, so the 40-hour work week, Henry Ford and his impact there happened in 1914. A lot of the earlier activism happened in the late 1800s. Back then, think about the difference between the company to employee relationship and what was available there versus today. So back then, you could only work for companies directly in your vicinity. Right? So directly in your town or your city that you could get to. You could only work when you were physically on the job, right? So you go into work and then when you leave work, you have no potential to bring home a laptop or anything like that. So working outside business hours was impossible. You not only could just work for companies in your vicinity, I assume you can only work for one company versus today you can work for several companies. You probably only had one job, one key job throughout your career that you were trained in versus today, you can switch jobs. You can evolve in your career every couple years, every couple months, even if that's what you're inclined to do. And then on top of that, I just want to remind everyone the technology that we have today. Back then, commercial flights didn't even exist. Today, we have a computer that can fit in your pocket, 5G networks. You can teleconference with anyone around the world at the snap of a finger. You can 3D print stuff. You can meet people in AR and VR. The things that allow us to work today are completely different as well. So what I'm getting at is just, to me, it sounds crazy. It's possible that it's the best approach, but it seems crazy that we are in a fundamentally different world of working and that people think that this must be the best approach to working in that environment. It may be, but I don't think we've done the work to actually test it because inertia and traditions have ushered us into continuously working this Monday to Friday, 9 to 5.
Absolutely. So I feel like we've beat the dead horse on the 40-hour work week and people are already really thinking about this one. And a related idea that I was thinking about as we were brainstorming for this podcast was retirement and how people think about that. So the idea of retirement, just for some quick history, came actually from the German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck in 1889 or around that time period. It was basically like those people who are disabled from work due to age have a claim from the state. And so the state helps support you in your later age. If I had to really simplify it, the basic paradigm of today or the default societal norm that we grew up with was you work 9 to 5, so the 40-hour work week for 40 to 50 years, and then you have a pension or social security or other things. And at that point, you start enjoying your life. And so when you're 65 or 70, you start collecting your payments and then you head to the beach and you drink your margaritas and you do nothing. And that's like the good life. That's the vision of it. What I find troubling about that idea is that I don't actually think that's the optimal way for us to approach our lives and our careers. And the reasons are as follows, at least this is my personal belief. The first is that we don't actually want to stop working. I think that we want to work hard during some periods and not during others. But at the end of the day, like you need some sort of purpose in your life. So whether it's raising kids or working in your career or just pursuing a hobby that really gets you going, this idea of doing nothing and enjoying your life after you've already worked really hard is silly to me because if you've ever tried to drink margaritas on the beach, you can do it for like a week. Trust me, I've tried. And then it gets pretty boring. Like I wanted to do something else with my time. And so I naturally started working. And the question is, am I working at a company and producing results that way? Or am I doing things that are interesting? Like maybe I'm reading books, maybe I'm building projects that will profit me in the future. There's like lots of opportunities these days. The second issue is that by the time you get to 65 or 70, I think about this all the time as I'm doing more like adventurous stuff that's hard on your body, like canyoning or big hikes. Am I going to be able to do those things when I'm 65 or 70? Am I even going to want to do those things? The answer is probably I'm less likely then to be able to go do some stuff that will create awesome memories for my life. And I'm not able to enjoy the full fruits of my labor at that age. So in my mind, I'm always like, no way. I'm not waiting until I'm 65. Like I'm going to do the stuff I want to do now while I'm still physically able and while I have the energy to do it. And while I also have the time and potentially fewer responsibilities. So my paradigm has become, you know, how can I work for a few years hard, save up some money, and maybe ideally build some passive income streams when I'm not working? I try not to have an expensive lifestyle so that I can be flexible here and actually take mini retirements. I think this idea is in the 4-hour work week, which is an extreme version of a potential new way of working. But this idea of taking like mini retirements, like right now I'm in one of them. I don't think I've been a W-2 employee. It's been like 4 or 5 months. I'm like building projects. I'm reading, I'm traveling, I'm doing things that kind of fill my bucket as I think about the next area that I really want to sink my teeth into and commit to really hard. And at the same time, I'm recharging myself. I'm refactoring my health beliefs. I'm doing things that are going to keep me in the game for the long run. That to me is a much more sustainable way of working. I find there's like lots of barriers to that outside of the cultural norm. Like people thinking things like, if I take a break from my career, employers will look at that badly. If I go pursue my passions, I'm going to miss this next opportunity. And I've shirked all of those things and said, no way. I think it's actually going to be way cooler for the employer to hear about my awesome story or the thing I learned about, or I'm going to find new opportunities because I'm able to be patient and I'm not going to be on this constant ladder of pursuing the next extra dollar, the next ladder in my career. And sure, I may miss out on some industries or opportunities. This is very industry dependent, but at least in the tech world, I do feel like there's more flexibility to really create different paradigms for yourself. And I wish more people would think about that when they're young, because I think when you get the cancer when you're old or something happens, like your partner dies, it's much harder to reshape your life. And you may actually have some regrets from not doing the things that you wanted to earlier on.
This is why people have midlife, quarter life, whatever it is, life crises, because they realize that all the things that they wanted to do in life, whether it was career focused or personal focused, they put off. And there's always a balance between doing things today that you want to do versus investing in the future. There's always going to be that balance. But I think at the end of the day, you and I do seem to agree on this idea that you really shouldn't trade today for tomorrow. And you can do it to some extent. We all do it to some extent, right? We save money today so that we can live more prosperously tomorrow. But I don't think you should fully trade one for the other, which is why both of us very early in our careers decided that we wouldn't sit in a cubicle. I did it for 10 months and I was like, that is it. One of the things I've actually noticed about what a lot of people say around me that I think is a form of tradition is that they'll say, I'll just spend 3 more years here and then I'll be good. Or let me just finish this degree. I don't really want to do it anymore, but it's just like a year and a half more and then I'll have the check mark and the diploma and I'll be good to go. Of course, again, there's always an element of balancing today with tomorrow. But the thing that I just find so crazy sometimes is we all have no idea how much longer we're going to spend on this earth. And it could be a lot longer with the way that some of the longevity science is moving, but it could also be like 3 more days. We don't know. This is something that I think you're actually more in touch with than I am. But what's crazy to me is a year of your life, let's just assume we all live to average 80, that's the lifespan today, is a not trivial portion of your life. And as you said, especially if it's in some of those younger years where you can do more, accomplish more, et cetera. I think we've both been in tune with that for a long time, but it's something that I encourage other people to do, like to not explain away your time and say, oh, it's just this much longer, because anything that is, especially in the years in magnitude of length, is a significant part of your life. And if you really hate your job or you're just doing something to check a box, I would question that, because a lot of those decisions are fueled by sunk costs instead of things that you actually should be pursuing. I think it relates to exactly what you're talking about of this tradition being retirement. I assume it has to partially do with the fact that in the past, you couldn't accumulate wealth in the same ways that you can today. And you also couldn't pursue things like side projects or these mini sabbaticals in the same ways that you can today. And of course, as you said, it depends on the industry that you're in. But today you actually can make a living off of your passions. You actually can take sabbaticals and during those sabbaticals, learn certain skills that are going to make you more lucrative in the job market. You can do things that you couldn't do before. I think tradition plays a huge role in this. I can even share one quick story from my mom. When I originally was in consulting, she had worked at IBM for around 2 decades. And she never really had a boss that invested in her in the ways that I had a boss at that time that was willing to invest in me. She said, Steph, you're never going to find this again. You should absolutely stay at this company. This is like a dime a dozen, and you should work your way up this ladder. Ultimately, if people are familiar with my story, I did not listen to her, but it was because she was born into and lived through this paradigm of staying at a company for so many years and thinking that if you migrated away from that ladder, that there weren't other ladders outside of that. What I think I'm getting at is this idea that today, I think actually you could either say there's several different ladders, or I think you could even just imagine it more like a tree and there's so many different paths that you can take. And as long as you're continuously investing in yourself in some way, I think the opportunities that exist are so abundant. And yes, I don't think you need to wait till retirement to live the life that you want to live.
And I think one of the important things is sometimes you need to get off the ladder that you're currently on or the mountain that you're climbing to even see that there are other ladders or mountains to climb. That's been my experience as well, is during those periods of downtime, was I the most productive and efficient person that I could have been? Potentially not. But at the same time, I was talking to new people. I was more open-minded and I started to see new paths. And once you see new paths, that's actually when you see all of those tree branches that may not be apparent when you're in any given path. A related and sticky idea to what you're talking about that I hear a lot is that you should never leave your current job until you have your next job. This leads to people just moving from company to company with 1 or 2 weeks in between. They never actually get a big break. And there's a lot of reasons why that's sage advice, like you have more negotiating leverage and you can still pay your bills while you're at your current job. I've completely thrown that idea to the side to the dismay of my grandfather and other members of my family. I've basically said, you know what? If I'm unhappy at this job, I'm just going to leave and then I'm going to figure it out right after that. Part of that has worked for me because I just believe in myself. Another thing is that I think you can make yourself more anti-fragile by developing a skill set that's in demand in the market. That way you can capture more opportunities and always re-enter when you want to in a more flexible way. And then other things like reducing your lifestyle expenses so that you don't actually have to make what your former salary was giving you to pay your bills. And that's a great way to, I think, create more flexibility. And a lot of people get in the trap of living a life that is even slightly beyond their means. And then you're trapped in the job and you can't think as flexibly here. Point being that it takes a little bit of guts to question the norm and saying, you know what? I actually don't need another job before I leave my current one. And that time and period, maybe it's a little scary, but I'm going to go figure that out. And that's actually going to enable exactly what I need, which is a period of rest, a period of learning, a more open mind that is not closed off to the opportunities that are just in front of me.
I think a visual that has helped me is we keep talking about this ladder in the corporate world. In the past, things were much more like a ladder. But as I said, you can reimagine that as a tree. And if you imagine a bunch of different branches on a tree, if you really want to get to the top, the branch that you start following first isn't always the one that will bring you to the very top. And so sometimes in order to get to the right branch, quote unquote, right branch, there's not always a correct one, but the one that will be best for you, you have to actually navigate down the branch that you're on. And so that's the part that, as you said, a lot of people don't want to do. A lot of people don't want to pause. A lot of people don't want this intermittent period where they don't feel like they're making progress. But that in itself may open them up to other opportunities. And I think you're right that because we are so entrenched in so many of the traditions that exist in our society, and we just see everyone following certain things, the friction to do that is pretty significant. There is a weight to going your own direction. Even if you internally feel confident in a decision, the weight of everyone else's opinions does impact the way that you think about things and your likelihood to actually move forward with one of those actions.
One thing that's worked really well for me, in case people are wondering how you can get good at this, the idea is not to just be reckless with your decisions. Like, I'm actually a very risk-averse person, but what I do is I pay attention to how I'm feeling. And if it's not good for a number of months for various reasons, I try to identify the sources and then figure out some solutions from there. So in the case of the career, you know, can you improve the current state of your work within a company? So maybe you can get a new role, maybe you can get new responsibilities. You can try that for a few months. And then if that doesn't work, maybe it actually is time to leave. Before you leave, you can talk to people in different industries, or you can kind of scope out what else is going on that you might have available to you. But the important part comes when you make the decision. And when I make these decisions, it often seems like I make them pretty haphazardly. Like, 1 week I'm at a company and then I'm like, you know what? I'm totally gone and I'm confident in that decision. What I do is I make the decision and then I gut check it with people that I trust. And I do that with different types of people. Like, I know my grandpa wants the best for me, so I'll tell him and see what he thinks, but I'm probably not going to change my mind there. And then I'll talk to other people. Like, I have a friend who is very high integrity and very logical. So I'll go test my logic and my thinking and really play that out. And then I have a more compassionate friend who's going to help me tap into the more emotional side of my decisions. I sort of vet the conclusion that I've come to. And I almost always stick with the conclusion, but I have much more conviction in it because I've tested all of the sides and pressure tested them from people who bring really different things to my life, who I trust a lot. That's helped me make these decisions. And I don't look to other people or my peers to say, hey, what are they doing? And to validate myself in that way. Because if you do that, there's always going to be someone who keeps you held within your path. And I found that sometimes that's actually because they're unhappy in their own path and they just want to, not intentionally, but hold you down with them and not see you change in the ways that you want to change, because that's actually an affront to their own identity. And that's an idea that could be 10 podcast episodes. But the point is, even people who have your best interests in mind, sometimes they're projecting their own beliefs and insecurities onto you. So you can't just take their ideas for what they are. You really have to come up with your own thinking, and then you'll have more resolve and conviction.
I would also encourage people to set arbitrary deadlines. One of my friends does this. She basically, when she's unhappy in a job, she will set a calendar reminder, let's say 3 months in advance or whatever it is, and just say, if I'm still feeling these things, then I'm going to make a decision and leave this company. I would encourage people to do this because I have personally seen so many people who, again, say things like, oh, I'll just do this for X amount of time. And sometimes it's years. I remember in my consulting role, I spent 10 months there. At around month 8, I had a conversation with a coworker of mine, and we were both unhappy there. We didn't hate the company. We just weren't happy there. We wanted to move on to other things. By month 10, I had left and joined another company. At that time, he was like, I'm leaving soon. I'm totally leaving soon. I went back 3 years later and he was still there. So it shows the effect of us, if you hear people saying boiling the frog, like once you're somewhere for long enough, once you're used to something for long enough, you just accept it. And I would encourage people not to accept it. That's the ethos of this episode, is not that tradition is bad, but just to learn to question things that exist around you, and not question things just so you can be a rebel, but question things to understand if this is really optimal for me or for you or whoever is assessing that, and use that information to craft your life. You hear people more these days use the term life design. I think that's really important because you as they say, only have one life to live. And if you're living your life prescribed basically by the traditions that other people have passed along to you, maybe that's a good life, but I actually think that it likely won't be the life that at the end of the day, you look back on, you're like, wow, I'm really happy with how I chose to live that life.
I love that idea of setting arbitrary deadlines. It reminded me that I've actually used that a few times in my career. In banking, we had this signing bonus that you'd have to get back if you didn't stay for a year. So at day like 240, I put a sticky note that I changed every single day on my desk. And I'm like, I'm literally leaving on the day that this year deadline hits. It started at 120 and then it slowly was counting down. I can't remember if anyone ever asked me about it, but I probably wanted to say this deadline actually means that I'm not going to be working with you in this number of days, but I didn't say that. I probably made up some other story. And then at another job, I was given a new role and I'm like, I'm going to give this 6 months. I'm going to see if this improves my conditions and try to stick it out instead of just going with the whims of my emotions. And at that 6 month point, about 2 months before, I checked in and I'm like, still not that happy. So I started preparing my affairs in order, getting the systems in place, and then also making sure I like reduce my burn and my expenses and other things that would just help me make that decision with confidence. So I think that can help a ton. To your idea on like the ethos of this podcast, I love that kind of concept that it's really just about trying to pay attention to the things around you and being willing to question them. And if you're up for it, I'd love to switch to our last topic, which is of a completely different flavor than the career situation.
Let's do it.
Cool. So I don't know exactly how to title this, but the broad concept is marriage, love, and monogamy. So I want to just start off with a brief history here. So the first fact that I find interesting is less than 5% of mammals are monogamous. And so humans are mammals, obviously. The ones that are monogamous, in case you're interested, there's turtle doves and swans and snow owls. The reality is that humans are not like biologically wired for monogamy. And I think this is a pretty interesting concept because at least the thing that's programmed into our brains today is for most people, you grow up and you find a partner and then you marry them and you're wed to them for your life. And this doesn't always work out, but you're also monogamous within that structure. And of course, some people break that. I want to talk about that in a bit. At the end of the day, humans are not actually biologically wired for this. This is like a social construct. We're biologically wired for survival and reproduction. And both of those can be facilitated by something like monogamy. But I want to quickly go into the history of marriage and things so we can get to some talking points here.
Okay, let's hear it.
So I think the most interesting place to start is humans came about like 300,000 years ago. And during the first 290,000 of those years, we were hunter-gatherers. And the way of our living, at least as it related to like social arrangements and sex and stuff like this, is we had multiple sexual partners and things like raising children were done at the communal level. That was just because everyone needed to support each other and we were focused on survival. But then as we developed, so this is like the agricultural revolution, which started, I think, 14,000 years ago and then went for another like 5 to 8,000 years, that led to this situation where we actually started living in more close quarters. And something that became really important during that time was property rights. And that's because the land was actually where you did your labor and that's where you produce your food that helped you survive. So people became really concerned with property rights in addition to the nuclear family becoming more important. So people are starting to settle into smaller units. Shortly after that, it's actually like 2500 BCE, the like concept of marriage comes about. And marriage actually has some not nefarious, but definitely suboptimal origins in that its primary purpose in the beginning was like to bind women to men, which basically guaranteed that children were truly like a man's biological heirs. And through the marriage, like a woman became a man's property. Of course, we don't think about it like that today. And that's pretty horrible. But just, I think that's something that's overlooked when we think about marriage today, because it's an idea that's really developed in quite profound ways over time. The last little bit here is religion becomes involved, and then something like marriage is sanctioned by the church and other things like this, and the state gets involved in that. And the final development here is actually, it was around the Industrial Revolution, the 1700s, where instead of marriage being this like purely practical arrangement where a man owns a woman and it helps cement property rights in the nuclear family and we all survive, marriage actually started being associated more with love, the core foundation between two people. And this leads us to our modern day, where the image that's bombarded in our mind is that you go about life and you find your one true love and you stick with that one true love for the rest of your life and you're sexually tied to them. And if you stray from that, then you're a bad person. That's like the basic paradigm that sits in our heads, but it developed from this kind of cede more like communal culture to, you know, something that was associated with property rights and something practical. And then love comes in and Hollywood and everything else that you hear from people bangs this idea into your head. And if you question that, then maybe you're this offender of this institution in this like natural way of being, despite it being actually pretty misaligned with how we've lived historically and also not aligned with our biological programming. The point I want to end on is something that I've always found very troubling. I'm not necessarily commenting on marriage or love or anything at this point, but it's that something like 40% plus of marriages fail. I don't think anyone goes into a marriage thinking, oh, this is not going to work out. 4 out of 10 and maybe even more don't work out. And I'm like, how do people just go into this? And I think it's easy to say, oh, that's not me. I love my partner. And then some shit happens and you end up divorced and it's a horrible experience. It's like stressful. There's all kinds of ramifications. The other fact that I find interesting is over 20% of people self-report as being unfaithful in their marriage. That to me is just absolutely mind-boggling. That's like self-reported numbers. When I think about that, I'm like, okay, so you have marriages failing and then you have all this infidelity. Like it has to be somewhat linked to our biological nature, like what we need in happiness as time goes on. But how many people are really questioning that path? I think it's actually quite hard to question the marriage path. It's quite hard to question the monogamy path. And sure, there's like pockets of things like polygamy and people are like swingers and stuff like this. But that's definitely not what the normal consensus conversation is about. And it's not what you see, despite it being something that actually may lead to an increased likelihood of something like a marriage working out. And I just wonder, is the foundation upon which this important societal structure of marriage is built and the rules that are typically within it, is that best served for everyone? At least from the data, it seems like no.
I have a bunch of reactions to this. The first is that I will just acknowledge that marriage and love and all of these stories have the exact structure of a tradition, right? It's something that we've been passed down. Society has told us X, Y, or Z, and therefore you believe it. A lot of the stories that we're told are told to us from someone else, whether it's our friend in society, whether it's a movie in a cinema, or our parents or our grandparents, they're told as these stories that we almost absorb without really acknowledging that we're absorbing them and without taking them with a critical eye and observing whether they, as we've talked about, really are the optimal case for us today. So I think the most important thing for people to do when they're thinking through traditions is first just acknowledge what is a tradition, what's not, right? What have I absorbed through my society or my family or my friends that I haven't consciously, like really, really consciously developed a thought on my own. So that's the first thing. Now, we talked through a couple different traditions. There are many more out there. This is one that I will say candidly that I struggle with, partially because as you start to go down the rabbit hole of any tradition, you do learn about the history and how, huh, does this really make sense? Or did I just absorb this without really critically thinking about it? But then, depending on how deeply rooted you are in a tradition, there is ego behind that. There's inertia behind it. There are stories behind it. And it's almost like part of your identity because you believe it so deeply. So I currently am in a monogamous relationship. And I will say the 40-hour work week, that was easy for me to be like, okay, this doesn't make sense. I'm flipping this on its head. I have no reason to work 40 hours and I have no hesitation to throw this tradition out the door. But this is one, especially I think, I'm not sure about this, but I have a feeling being a woman, being prescribed all of these stories for many years, it really starts to become ingrained in you and it becomes hard to dissociate from a tradition if it's that deeply rooted. And it becomes hard to identify, okay, am I actually okay with being this deeply rooted and just accepting this tradition? Or do I want to migrate away from it? And the hard part about this topic in particular for me is that, yes, you made it clear, and I think a lot of people have, that monogamy often doesn't work, but there is that seed of, but sometimes it works, right? And then that's coupled with the idea that there isn't really a solution that has proven to work outside of that, in the sense that, yes, a lot of polygamous couples are happy and there's other kind of forms of relationships out there, but those are relatively new, at least in our society, of welcoming them and people testing them out. And so I think what becomes even harder to do when you are assessing a tradition is if there's not really something there that you feel confident in. I'll just leave it there, where it's something that I guess I would put it as, some traditions I feel very ready to leave behind. I feel like when you're combating a tradition to a degree, there's some grief there because you've been told a story your whole life and you're debating whether you want to let it go. And so just like with grief, the first stage is like shock and denial, but it's also just understanding how it's shaped you and again, that history. So I'm at that stage for this specific topic, but I think it has merit. And I think the reason that this topic is something that so many people are unable to talk about, whether it's publicly or in their relationships, is because of that like shock, denial, and guilt, and not necessarily knowing how to engage in those conversations. Because again, we've been told a lot of these stories for a very long time.
Yeah, there's a ton to unpack there, but I think what you said was pretty head on in terms of the challenge of people questioning something that is like deeply ingrained. And at least in the conversations I've had, people are much more willing to talk about the 40-hour work week and question that than this idea, does our current structure of marriage, love, and monogamy make sense? I think one of the things you said is that other structures like polygamy are new in our society and we haven't really seen whether they're successful or not. And what's interesting is they're very new to the modern conversation, at least in our openness to talk about them. But that was the default structure for most of human history.
I know.
And so it's proved itself out at least within that structure. But what's interesting is you can't deny like our current situation. And I don't have the answers here. And I actually think we're moving to a place where the answers are quite different depending on who you are and what you want out of your life. And so just a couple of ideas I want to throw out there is I don't think just because a bunch of marriages end or humans are not naturally monogamous, that people shouldn't strive to be monogamous. If I had to guess, monogamy increases trust. It means you're less likely to bring like sexual disease to your family. It might force you to invest more in your partner when things aren't going well. There's probably a lot of things that it gives as a boon to most marriages, but there may be some cases. I don't know. I always think, let's say you're 20 years into your marriage and you needed to feel like a wanted person again, and you couldn't find that from your partner and you went and found someone who made you feel wanted and you returned to your partner even stronger or something. I'm sure there's lots of cases of this, of actually people who have been unfaithful and come back and then they actually had like a stronger marriage or something. The problem is that the marriage is often based on this idea of monogamy. So when you go outside of that, you completely break the trust of that pact that you made. And that's often something that would be very hard to bounce back from. Like an alternative that I think people could engage in, and I'm sure many people do. I just don't know how many people do because no one ever talks about this stuff super openly. But say you had a more flexible marriage where it was like not completely open or you're not polygamous. Like the idea of being essentially married to four people to me, stressful. But like the idea of someone having some like more open structure or some rules around it, I actually think it for some people could not only increase the likelihood that they keep this partnership that they're forming longer term, but it also forces more open communication about things like, hey, this is what I need. How do you respond to this? What are our rules around this? That actually can build like more trust because people are being honest and they're not hiding in the shadows, which is my whole issue with what happens today is people hide in the shadows. They break the pact and they like just destroy people and their images of themselves by going outside of that. At a minimum with this topic, what I wish more people would talk about is their struggles with the current setups. And I think what's a shame is if people end up on a path for 10 or 20 years and they're deeply unhappy and they don't know why. I think it's also a fallacy to say, oh, monogamy is the cause of marriages not working out. As I mentioned, it probably leads to some positive things. It probably leads to some negative things. And it actually may be like that open communication and trust is the biggest predictor of marriage success, or complimenting your partner so they feel positive emotions is like a really important thing. And it's not actually about the sexual thing, but it's actually more about people talking and building something over the long term. The last thing that I'd love your thoughts on, though, is we talked about the sexual piece of this, but I think another thing is this concept of love. If I said, hey, Steph, what does love mean to you? Actually, just tell us, what does it?
You're putting me on the spot. I don't have a definition for love. I think what you're getting at probably is this idea that we have these constructs in our head. And again, they're traditions. They're passed down to us. Like I have this sentiment in my head. There's probably some neurons that fire when I hear the word love or when I say it. But I don't know if I could actually articulate what love is. Like, I don't know if it's the fact that you would sacrifice your life for someone else. Like, I feel that way for parts of my family, but is that the definition of love? Or is it that you are willing to share everything with someone? I don't know what the definition of love is. And I don't think many people would be able to articulate that, because let's just actually look up real quick. What is the definition of love? According to Google, it is an intense feeling of deep affection, which like, what does that mean? And just like many other things in life, it occurs on a spectrum. and changes over time with one individual. So I don't know is my answer.
And that's probably the case for most people, including myself. I don't have a succinct definition of love, but a couple of like ideas around love that I think are worth noodling on is, at least as it relates to like partners and marriage and stuff like that, there's the idea of the soulmate or the one true love. And I think many people walk around being like, I need to find my perfect person. And I've met a lot of people who have dated people who are probably pretty good and stuff like this, but they're always looking for that true love. And I just wonder if that idea is the exact idea that's preventing you from finding the one true love because you have this like over idealized image of what it means to love. It also probably causes issues in relationships where there really is like a loving trust and bond that could last a long time. Imagine that you thought that love meant that you never argued with someone or that you never felt disdain for someone. You may run away at the first sight of conflict in a relationship. And I think anyone who's been in a long-term relationship, if you don't have any conflict, please do call me because that would be a fascinating thing to hear about how you actually manage that. My point being that I think we walk around with these like loose definitions and ideas, and that can not only impact how you approach something like marriage. And the other thing is most people, if they do the traditional route, are associating love with monogamy as well. Like you would hear something like, if you truly love me, you would never want to be with someone else, despite the biological case for most people. Like desire, you can't take that away. What you can take away is like someone acting on that desire because they've made a pact with someone else. And I think that's totally sensible. But to have the idea that you're so love blind or love drunk, and that goes into perpetuity, that you would never kind of consider being with someone else or be able to feel love from someone else, to me is not an idea that's consistent with what I think most humans feel. And just to give more of the personal perspective, I've met strangers, and these are not just romantic encounters. You have this amazing conversation and you connect on this deep visceral level. And in some ways that I could think of as love, like this unbinding connection to someone else, even if it's just like a person you're, you know, having an awesome conversation with, and it has nothing to do with sex or something that's enduring, but it's like a one day form of true human connection to someone else. And I just think it's cool to step back and really think about these things. And maybe we should sit down and define our definitions of love. But in this case, it strikes me as something that's sad that so many things that start out as promising, such as a marriage, end in something probably on the top list of stressful things for people, which is divorce. That leads to more conflict and an identity crisis. And that to me, I think in part could be solved by more flexible structures and ways we can think about things like love, your sexual relationship with your partner, even say like your living arrangement. I think a lot of people don't, because this like tradition in this story is pounded in our face by movies and other people that doesn't actually work for you, is just very hard to fight against, even to question at all.
Yeah. So I have two quick things to say. One of them is, do you know what the key difference is between humans and other animals?
My guess would be like our awareness of ourselves.
So that may also be true, but I heard this on a podcast recently, the All In podcast. David Friedberg said this, but he said that the one key thing, the key difference, is that humans are the species that can invent narratives. So things that don't actually exist, we can invent those narratives, those stories, and we can convince other people of them. Monkeys and other species, they can create tools, they can work together as communities, they can do a lot of the things that we can today, but humans invent narratives and other species don't seem to invent these narratives in the same way. And I'm bringing this up because this relates directly to what we've discussed this whole episode, which is things that we believe because other people have told us. And in some cases, they truly exist and they truly should exist. But sometimes they are kind of just storylines that we come to believe, like love, which depending on how you define it, has an existence, but also is this like super fuzzy thing that I think many people couldn't actually define. Now, the second thing I was going to say is related to that, which I think is just a kind of funny way to think about love, but Algorithms to Live By is a book I often recommend. And in that book, they talk about the 37% rule. And the whole book is really, how do we take very complex topics and issues and problems that exist in human life, which is very fuzzy, and approach it like a computer, which is not fuzzy at all. It's zeros and ones. So with the 37% rule, a lot of people ask, when do I know if it's the one? When do I know when to settle down? And in that case, they take the 37% rule from computer science, which means that you explore for a period of time. So imagine that you want to be married by the time you're 30 and you start dating when you're 18, that's 12 years. You take 37% of that and you explore, you date all the people you possibly can, you don't settle down at all. And then after that, you exploit, meaning you choose the next person you meet that is just as good or better than anyone you met during the 37% period. That's who you should settle down with. The reason I'm mentioning this is because many people would say that is so emotionless and that absolutely cannot be love. But in some way, you could say that is love. You've gone and you've explored, you've identified what you want in life, and then you found someone who fits those needs, and hopefully you fit their needs, and you make a pact and you decide to be together. Which, again, it's not this storyline, this narrative that we're used to hearing, but that I think effectively could be love just as much as the stories that we tell ourselves every single day.
Yeah, that's definitely an approach to dating and life that I don't know that a lot of people actually do or would be open to thinking about, but it aligns a lot more with how I think about what you might do if you were truly trying to spend your life with one person. And the way that I personally approach this is I think that in the long run, what you want to do is you want to build like a partnership with someone. And that partnership can't just be based on like the fiery passion that you feel for someone in the first year. It has to be based on something that endures, and it requires that you like grow with that person over time. So ideally, it's a person who can grow with you, and they may grow in different ways, which I think is what actually happens in lots of marriages and maybe ends them, which is just a natural thing. But the point being that you have to invest in that as you would any other partnership. Like you have to nurture it. You have to be willing to make sacrifices. You have to do the things that are required to make that partnership work. And it can't be based on this loose idea that like your fiery love is going to last into perpetuity, because probably when the shit hits the fan in the relationship or other parts of your life, you may change in profound ways. And do you want that person who you just felt like passion for, or do you want the person who is actually going to be there for you and willing to make that commitment? I think one way that people can do this is they can sit down and actually talk about some of these things. Like, hey, what do you want out of money? What do you expect out of raising children? What do you want your retirement to look like? What do you think that you would want from me over the next 20 years? If you actually sat down and did that with someone, which my guess is very few people do that, you might be able to highlight areas where things may go awry or where there's like big values disconnects. Maybe you're Jewish and your wife is Christian, and you start talking about raising children and you're like, they have to be Jewish. And she's like, they have to be Christian. Okay. Maybe that's something that you want to solve before you go and have kids and start fighting about this thing that you may fundamentally disagree on. If nothing else, throwing aside all the stuff about monogamy and whether the one true love exists, thinking about marriage and staying with someone as this long-term partnership that you invest in, to me, is like a healthier way to approach it. And when I say healthier, I mean, it increases the probability that you will be successful, and it may not guarantee it. But that's how I try to think about these things, even if it seems a little bit too logical or robotic and is distasteful for those looking for the one true love or those who have found it.
No, but I think what's important to call out here is that as you start to dive into certain topics, if you find yourself being emotional about something, it's not necessarily that you're wrong about it, but just note that you're probably emotional because it's tied in some way to your identity and the stories that you've been told. And you're likely getting emotional because you're having this, as people say, come to Jesus moment of, oh my gosh, like people have been telling me these stories. Are these stories true? Have I been lied to? Or like, how did I not realize this before? Or why did I never question this before? And again, it's not necessarily saying that the stories you've been told are wrong or have malintent or anything like that, but it's more so that I actually think that sometimes we stray away from robotic or really thoughtful data-driven approaches to life because people say that they're too robotic, they're too whatever. It's not so much that you need to think like a robot. I don't encourage that, but if you are having emotional responses, just question whether you've paired that with the thoughtful response that I think should come with it. I know we've been talking about this topic for a while, and there are endless traditions that we could talk about, whether it's why we eat 3 meals a day, how we track time across the world. I would encourage you all to, whether it's something that may seem trivial or something that seems very major, like love and marriage, to go and learn about the history or the origins of these traditions. That's the kind of first thing that I would encourage people to do. Because again, it's not so much to say, I want to rebel and everything is wrong. There's a reason that traditions exist, but it's important that you get to the origin of why, because then you can make the determination of whether you agree with that and you want to continue following that tradition, or whether you want to make minor or major changes in your life that don't necessarily adhere to that.
What you just said reminded me of why I think traveling internationally, at least in some capacity when you're young, is such a useful thing. you are exposed to different traditions by the nature of going to different countries and talking to people from there, even if they're subtle. You pick up all these different pieces and your basic conclusion is like, oh, people can live a different way and they can still be happy and just like me. And they're actually just living differently. And what I think is cool about that is that you get this exposure to new ideas that help you have perspective on the values that are just ingrained in you from where you grew up, which is completely random, by the way. And you can question them by gaining awareness of them. And at the same time, see new ways of living that you could either choose to adopt or reject in your life. If you adopt it, it's likely that you found a new way of living that improves the quality of your life. If you reject it, it often means that you actually really align with the culture that you grew up in and the tradition that exists there. And now you're aware of it and you probably have more conviction in it. I think that's just one of the ways in which you can get perspectives. If you can't go travel or something, try to do this in the abstract. Ask yourself, if I was born in a Buddhist monastery in Thailand, would I have the same ideas that I do now about politics, about religion, about marriage? Then flash forward to another country. If I was born impoverished in Nicaragua under a hostile political regime, would I hold the same beliefs that I do about income inequality or whatever it is that you believe and you might want to question? A lot of those would be completely turned upside down if you were born into different circumstances. It's particularly important to do something like this from my perspective if, as you mentioned, you start getting really emotional in a way that maybe your ego is being attacked. If you feel that you're just absolutely right and if your blood is starting to boil, that's actually a really good sign that you might want to step back and think, why am I having this reaction? Is it my identity that's being attacked, or am I actually just so right that I need to scream at the other person who's causing this? And more often than not, it's likely that you've tied something to your identity in a way that actually could just be a tradition that you have never questioned. It may be something that you genuinely believe, and that's fine. You can be passionate about causes, but I think it's always important to step back and really think about things, and transporting yourself to another place in a different era is a great way to do that. Last tip on that one is I've been trying to read books from the 1800s and before of late. And part of that is because the 1800s were way different. The way that we treated people of different races and genders and just even the way of life, radically different. And instead of just ignoring that, I'm reading those things to try to figure out like what was life like back then. And a lot of things don't seem nearly as good as they are today. And I think it's useful to just even have that perspective, especially as you start commenting on today's issues or where we're at and how things are. Just going back in time and really seeing things and how things have progressed is another way to get perspective without leaving your couch.
Can I take a little bit of a left turn and just say something related to that, which is I recently watched the bear attack scene in The Revenant because I was in Alaska and saw some bears. And The Revenant is based on this guy called Hugh Glass. I guess he was alive in the early 1800s and he lived a wild life. In addition to his bear attack, there was a bunch of other stuff that happened to him. And I remember the top comment on that video, or one of them, was, "Someone please remind me of this video every time I complain about my life today." You just reminded me of that because there are so many different areas of life, and our mindset for thinking about things tends to be just really rooted in the last couple decades when humans have been around for a lot longer and we probably live in the best time in history that at least I can think of. But bringing us back to the episode and closing it out, I wanted to double down on what you said about traveling and collecting experiences or perspectives. I think that's really important because, as I mentioned earlier in the episode, I've noticed how everyone, including myself, we are very quick to adopt narratives from other people and not question them. But then things that seem new or we've never heard before or society hasn't really told us, we are very quick to question, right? And I think the only way that you can start breaking down some of those barriers is by testing them or living them. So the same way that I think it's funny that both you and I had worked remotely for years and been questioned by so many people, those same people finally, when they had been forced to just try it, they realized that, oh, this isn't so bad, or there are definitely things that we can work on, but we can solve these problems. And this is not quite what I imagined. I think the same thing happens when people have this understanding of the world and then they get transported to another country for one reason or the other. And then they just realize that a lot of the things they believed were not true. But I really don't think sometimes you can tell people that. They need to experience it. So what I'm getting at is, as you start to break down or address some of the traditions that may have shaped you, again, they're not necessarily wrong. wrong, but I would encourage you to go just try new things in your life. Because as you said, you either come back realizing, oh, that really wasn't so bad, and maybe I should explore some of these avenues more, or you come back and you actually have more conviction about what you were taught, but you have that primary source of conviction instead of it being passed down through the line.
100%. And I think a lot of people would maybe resist this idea and say, I don't need to travel because I know everything I need to know and I like my country. Something that I experienced, and I traveled mostly for the first time as an adult, but many of the ideas I had about other countries and even my ideas about American politics and certain social issues completely changed as I went to other countries. If you drive through like shanty towns in Brazil or Colombia or neighborhoods in Nicaragua, I think I grew up by US standards, low income, like a mom who made less than $15,000 a year. Well, when I drove through those places, I saw what real on the ground poverty looks like. Like, I still had food on the table. I still had other things. And yes, by US standards, I was poor, and I wish I would have had more money growing up because it would have made things easier. But it actually reshaped my perspective on what poverty can look like. And there's even areas worse than the places I've gone. And the same is true for a host of other social issues. So if you're from one place and you've never been to other places, it's often true that your perspective is really heavily anchored on the place that you're at, and just getting somewhere else can transport your perspective in what I think of are healthy ways, and that help connect you to the full global ecosystem of people and humanity. And in some ways that everyone is just trying to live a good life and they have different approaches to that. And we should all help each other in some way, shape, or form and start to think about things from that perspective. So I don't want that to sound preachy, but I just wanted to give a specific example, particularly if you're feeling averse to this idea of traveling, which at least for most of my family, they're not actually very interested in traveling internationally and think that the US is the greatest country in the world and things like this. And I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that. I just think it's a perspective that doesn't capture the full balance of the world.
Very true. I wanted to add one final thing before we close out this episode, which relates to innovation. We've talked about the 40-hour work week. We've talked about love. We've talked about all types of things as it relates to tradition. I want to encourage people to think past that and think about how tradition impacts the way that we innovate. When you're innovating, you're trying to think of something net new that improves the world. You are inevitably influenced by what already exists. But your ability to almost remove what already exists can actually allow you to think through innovation in a much more effective way. So you see this in tons of countries where, for example, innovations leapfrog one another because they didn't have the existing infrastructure to muddle their thinking. Instead, they just thought through from first principles, what is the best thing that we can go with today? So that's why you see countries in Africa, for example, they didn't start with dial-up just because other countries did that. They said, what's the best thing that exists today? And they went straight to cell phones and probably 3 or 4G. So the reason I'm mentioning this is because narratives don't just impact the stories that exist in our lives, but it's important to think through how what exists today influences how we think the future can be tomorrow.
The idea you're touching on is really important, and maybe we should actually talk about it in an episode about innovation. But when big disruptive innovations come, say a new industry emerges, almost always it's from people who were outside of the legacy industry. So just a quick example, in the late 1800s, the telegraph was how we communicated, and there was people who really wanted to make the telephone a thing. And so the big like player in the telegraph industry, they got into phones briefly, but there was actually a new startup, which was the Bell Company, which became AT&T, which became a big monopoly that was later broken up in 1984 and really transformed our communications with the telephone, that actually capitalized on that opportunity. And it's partially because they weren't constrained to the ideas of the telegraph industry, and also partially because the telephone didn't just change telegraphs, it actually completely wiped out our need for them. And so often when you're on the inside of something, you actually have to destroy and reinvent yourself to get to the innovation that may be the next cycle of things. And I would bring that down to the personal level as well. One thing that's really hard as you go about and change your beliefs is you have to destroy pieces of your identity, which is really hard because you have to first be aware of them, then question them, and then change them. That may change things in your relationships with people or just your overall worldview. And you have to almost like self-destruct to then reinvent to something that is better for you.
The same thing happened with the Wright brothers. I can't remember what they were working on before planes, but they were not in the airplane industry. Maybe it was bikes or something like that, but they brought that knowledge and applied it to the airplane industry. Overall, I think we should definitely have a conversation around technology and how new technologies evolve. And I think one really fun episode would be about how people are really averse to new technologies. People think people are afraid of AI or biohacking today. People have been afraid of trains, planes, all forms of technology since they existed, because anything net new, people have visceral reactions to. They're not used to them and they seem scary. So maybe that's an episode we'll do soon. But overall, I think this was a very lengthy but interesting episode about narratives and traditions that impact every single one of us.
Well, I want to end on two rapid fire questions, and I'm going to put you on the spot, Steph. But does the one true love exist?
No.
What is the optimal alternative to the 40-hour work week?
I think it depends what job you do and also how you as a human work, but I don't think it's 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. I personally like to front load my week and I work very asynchronously. So I work when I'm best. I know that is not possible for many people, but I think for the people that have that available to them, the flexibility, go figure out how you work best. And I think be unapologetic about how you work best, because that inevitably is also best for the company because you'll get more done.
Yeah. And if you can deliver results, you get all of the leverage in that equation. So don't just work less because you think it's a good idea, but if it actually helps you do better or restructure your days, then that makes a lot more sense. I think my personal alternative to the 40-hour work week would be some sort of model that integrates more time off. I'm more of like a sprint worker. Like I like to go for like 2 or 3 months and then take a period of time off. That's always made it a challenge for me to do the 9 to 5, 50 weeks a year type of job, because I need some sort of like substantial break between that cycle, because I end up burning out in a different way. And of course, I could work more sustainably, but I think more flexible structures as it relates to mini sabbaticals could help retain employees, which in the long run is less expensive than finding someone else. All right. So we should definitely wrap it up here. We've covered heaps in this episode, including some spicy topics, and I hope everyone found it interesting.
If you found this episode interesting, don't forget to let us know. You can reach me at StephSmithIO on Twitter.
And you can reach me at Calvin_Rosser on Twitter.
Thanks for listening.
Till next time.